Hi, everybody. I am Ruth Jefferson, and this is Dr. Scott Goschuk. We are here today for the Ruth and Scott podcast. We will be coming to you at least once a month with new episodes to talk about topics like entrepreneurship, relationships, race and tech, and culture and food.
Hello, everyone. My name is Scott Goschuk, and just to tell you a little bit about me, my background is, for the most part, education. I grew up in urban Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and saw a lot of different things, experienced a lot of different things that eventually led me into education. I actually thought that McDonald's was going to be my career. I, at one point in time, was the youngest salary manager in McDonald's history at age 18, and you know, getting into Hamburger University and really had that plan for the track of, you know, maybe someday owning my own McDonald's, whatever it would be, but was working for the corporation and the corporate stores. And they would transfer me from struggling store to struggling store to struggling store, and I would go in and get it fixed up to where it could be managed, and then they would send me to the next struggling store. And as I learned more and saw more and worked very much in the inner city urban environment, it led me to a different track. It led me to a track of looking at education as to how can I make a more positive impact upon the populations that I was serving, and starting at a younger age. So I got into education, became a teacher and a principal. Again, always inner city urban, so Milwaukee, Atlanta, Minneapolis, and then I went back to Atlanta, taught at a university there for a couple of years, and then came back here to Minneapolis, where I currently live on the north side of Minneapolis, and I still work with education, a co-founder of a charter school here in St. Paul, Minnesota. But now I work more with leadership development and culture building and training and executive coaching and strategic planning. So still trying to help groups and teams and organizations, but in different ways now. And as we look at this podcast, as Ruth and I have met and we've talked, we're going to be going into different topics. We're going to be talking about different things and try to give, you know, real life perspectives on, you know, current events, as well as maybe historical pieces and much more to come. But we just want to have a chance to talk, and we want to welcome you in to those conversations in many different ways as we go forward. So as we begin to get this kicked off, it's an honor and a privilege to be here with you and look forward to greater things still to come. So thanks for your time. Thanks for the opportunity to serve. And let's get the conversation going. I'd also like to just take a moment and introduce my partner. I'll call her my esteemed partner. She would be too modest with that, but again, it's great to be working with Ruth Jefferson. And a little bit about her is, again, you know, as I grew up in the Midwest in that area, she grew up much more in the South and in Texas, Mississippi. Really considers herself to be an Army brat, traveling around with that. But again, her background and her diversity of experiences brings a wealth of knowledge and just real life approach to this podcast. So it's a blessing and an honor to be working with her on this. She has an undergrad degree in communications. So again, the ability to share information. She has a graduate degree in curriculum and instruction. She's currently working on dual certificates in marketing analytics and marketing management. So again, how to really get things out there, how to really reach people. And with all of that diverse background, that's really been Ruth's focus in her life, is to serve and to help and to assist and to be there for people in real life, real ways. So again, as we go through this and as Ruth and I interact, you're going to see, again, some many differences, but you're going to see unity in purpose. You're going to see unity in us working together as we learn from each other and help each other to grow and hopefully give you all things to grow from and to use to make a positive difference in your life. So welcome to my partner, Ruth, as we go into the Ruth and Scott podcast.
And with that, one of the things that I kind of want us to jump into today is the conversation around race and tech. So specifically, one of the things that's really been standing out to me is the use of AI, specifically looking at the way that AI impacts ethics and community racism and other things as well.
About your expertise with this. So when you're talking about the race and tech and ethics, tell me more. What do you mean about that? You know me well enough. Computers, AI, all this, it's almost like a foreign language to me. I know it's important and I know I should know more, so I'm going to learn from you today. But when you talk about, you know, AI and ethics with race specifically, What are you talking about? Where are you going with that? What are your thoughts and ideas?
Well, AI in general is a tool, and it can be a very helpful tool. It can help with things like business and even academics and even just things in life in general. However, it can also be a very dangerous tool if it's put into the wrong hands. And so that's where we kind of get into the conversations around ethics and specifically also about race. Because as you look at some of the ways that AI has been abused, and has been abused in such a way that it creates these sorts of negative perceptions around people and people groups. One of the things that might stand out is the example that happened not too long ago about AI being used on the White House website in referring to Barack and Michelle Obama as monkeys. Then there's also other things that you end up seeing that do things like propagate stereotypes and kind of encourage greater division in that sense. And so AI has a really interesting role, especially as we think about ethics and race.
You said dangerous. So I think I can intimate what you're going for, what you're talking about there with the dangerous piece. But can you elaborate on that? Can you give some thoughts as to what are maybe some specifics when you say dangerous?
So when we're talking about danger, one of the things that has been used throughout history in order to create more of an us versus them mentality is the use of images and negative perceptions and stereotypes as propagated through even other instances or iterations of science. And so as we're looking at this, AI provides a way of adding additional measures to the visual feedback that people are getting that are propagating stereotypes. For example, displaying certain people groups as lazy, as criminals, and as engaging in sort of stereotypical behavior. One of the results that has is it causes greater dehumanization. And so if you want to create an us versus them mentality that facilitates greater exclusion and makes people feel like it's okay to treat people in ways that are harmful, then AI is being used as a tool for that. And there are a lot of different ways that it could actually worsen in the way that it's used for that as well.
Thanks. That makes sense. And when you talk about this too, and a lot of times when we talk about technology, race, And really that there's even a gap. And with my background of working with students, again, in inner city urban schools, where the majority of my schools were, 100% or close to it, free and reduced lunch, et cetera. So access from a socioeconomic status, I worked with very, very low level groups, areas, lived there, et cetera. Do you see the same thing with access, though, Ruth, that the access to AI too, so I'm sorry, I'll just finish this, that the access to AI because of this too creates a discrepancy because of socioeconomic status and potentially that having a racial impact also, or am I way off base?
Can you rephrase that question? Because I feel sure. Like I got a little bit lost in the wording.
Yeah, no, I rambled a little bit there. So really what I'm saying is, do you see potentially too part of the danger of AI that people that have greater wealth, power, and status are going to control it and dictate it, and that people that, again, are coming from lower socioeconomic status from immigrants to et cetera, from different minority populations are going to have lesser access, so that even creates more danger?
I would definitely say that the socioeconomic factor definitely plays a role, as well as just power in general. For example, if we look even back within the last couple of weeks and the conversation that's happened around Anthropic and the government's use of that and potential fear between ChatGPT versus Claude AI and how people are concerned that AI will be used in that sense, even in terms of autonomous weapons. Those are things that we see as far as like uses and abuses of AI. I would say it just kind of opens up more doors for what you're thinking about in terms of how it can be harmful to other people. But also, I would be interested in kind of getting more of your thoughts, because one of the things that you mentioned kind of as you were asking the question the first time is like your work with people in different socioeconomic statuses. So the question that I would ask you is, in working with those people and also in working with people who are kind of maybe looking at that from the outside in, what are some challenges that you notice as far as like the perception with that? Because the other thing is, technology in a lot of ways is just a reflection of society as a whole. It's kind of more of a microcosm than it is something entirely different.
Yeah, so where I'm seeing more is schools. So in the world of education, I view it as an issue. And I don't know that it's an equalizer. I don't know that it's a terrible thing. I don't know that we have enough on it yet, but I know there's a lot of discussions and talks on it and a lot of policies and things. But again, I see, you know, from young students to high school, college, et cetera, you know, utilizing AI to write their papers, to do all the research. You know, back in the day for me, it was an encyclopedia. You know, don't copy things out of an encyclopedia. Well, now people can just AI their topic and write an entire paper. So again, I see some of those pieces, and I don't see it helping. And again, I'm a real novice with this. I don't have a lot, but I also don't see the populations with which I'm working are really into AI, and that maybe gives me pause for concern that they're going to be left behind and that AI is going to create this bigger gap between the haves and the have-nots. And that's a concern I have with it. I don't know. So again, I don't want to talk all negative either, but so here's again my pushback, and it's because I don't really use AI. So everyone's encouraged me to use AI and do more with it. I just have not. I'm still maybe too old fashioned with things. I'm not sure, but can you give me some positive things with it, Ruth, that you see? Can you see some things where it's not just a concern, where even from a race and tech standpoint that AI could be good? Did you have any thoughts on that?
Definitely, and I'll get to that in a second. But also I want to give you kind of some additional feedback so we can kind of speak to the question that I was asking earlier.
Yep.
Kind of stepping aside from the technology, when it comes to people that you're working with and working with different schools who are maybe not necessarily your students or within the families of your students, what are you noticing as far as like perceptions as far as that? Like, what were some of the things that you noticed in that kind of a role?
Yeah, what I've noticed is it's not a huge topic of conversation as much as maybe the media presents it, or, you know, again, those that are really online are presenting it. I don't really hear a lot from them with it and how they're utilizing one way or the other. I do know that, like I said, it's there to write their. So I guess here. So some of what I've seen is that they'll use the AI to write any type of narrative that they have. So from, again, the even text messaging, just AIing it. And I don't know that anyone even reads what they're doing. I think that there, you know, there's use of it with all of that. So we're losing, from my perspective, what I'm hearing from people is we're really losing even more of the personal touch with it. So
can you tell me more about that?
Yeah. So going further with that. So I've had, again, the ability to work with and working currently with many, many different people from many different walks of life, from socioeconomic status differences to ethnic differences to cultural differences. And I can tell you that, right, so living here in Minneapolis, it is even amplified to the nth degree, the differences between people. And what I see is that we are very much in an area where people are predominantly living in, if you want to call it, the basement side, the downside to differences between people. Rather than embracing differences, we are amplifying those differences in negative ways. And so I can tell you the gaps between, you know, the African-American population and the white population, it's growing bigger. It's growing bigger, not in a good way, and in a very negative way. I can tell you here, because of things that are happening, the gap between the African-American population and the African immigrant population is becoming more divisive and more destructive. I can tell you that the from a socioeconomic standpoint, that the discussions and the realities and the perceptions between those that have the financial resources to those that don't, it's just growing wider. And there's a lot of hurt, there's a lot of pain, and there's a lot of suffering here. And just, I'm concerned. It bothers me. And I see it every day. Anyone watching this, I'm sure you've seen the riots, you've seen the protests. They're real, and it's because of this tremendous divide. It's because of a lot of hurt, a lot of pain, a lot of terrible policies, a lot of misuse and abuse of power. But it's just getting worse, Ruth. So again, as you're asking me, well, what do I see in my people? I see a lot of pain. I see a lot of hurt. I see a lot of suffering. And it's not getting better. It's only getting worse right now. And it's, quite honestly, it's somewhat depressing. All right. So Ruth, maybe bring this a little bit full circle. And I haven't been all that clear. But my concern in working environments I work with and serve, my concern, maybe it's invalid. But again, I just see those that are coming from more affluent lifestyles, higher socioeconomic status, are going to have all this access to these wonderful tools and resources that AI can provide. And instead of using that for good, I can see that, or my concern is, again, and it's backed up from a historical perspective with many other things, is that they're going to abuse that and use that to even widen the gap between the haves and the have-nots. And so, again, those coming from a lower socioeconomic, it concerns me, and again, maybe it's invalid, that they're going to have less access to quality AI and they're going to be left behind again, left behind. It frustrates me now. I don't know if it's a reality, but that's where I was thinking a little bit. Your thoughts.
So in terms of that, AI can definitely create or contribute to those disparities in that way, but also in some ways it can bridge gaps because of the fact that it enables people to amplify what they are able to do. One of the things that you maybe mentioned before is how people are using it for like classwork assignments to do them and things like that. One of the things that we find when looking at that is the AI that people generally have access to is not capable of doing those things without oversight. And so what that means is that there is still a need for human input. However, the combination of human and technology is able to kind of help to bridge some of that. When it comes to the race and ethics point is when we start to get into more of that disparity, especially because of the amplification of toxic voices.
No, thanks. I appreciate both sides of that. I hadn't really necessarily thought of it like that previously. Thanks. That helps a lot.
All right. So we talked a little bit about race and tech, especially looking into that concept of AI. But something also that's interesting is kind of looking into some more of these relational pieces as it relates to our overarching theme today. So, Scott, did you have anything that you wanted to say maybe about like parenting and mentorship?
Yeah. So speaking of parenting and mentorship, yeah, it's certainly a topic that I deal with a lot and near and dear to my heart. And again, there are some real parallels here. I'll give a differentiation between parenting and mentoring in a second. But what I would say are the main points with parenting is, again, it comes back to an overarching term. And really, I would even apply this to mentoring, maybe a slight differential, but it comes back to an overarching piece, love. So again, when we talk about relationships, I don't care what they are, it comes back to love. And love is a word that has been taken away from us in our society today. Because if I go in the workplace and start telling all my coworkers I love them, pretty soon I'm going to be sent to HR for microaggressions and different things that way, because they're going to misinterpret my statement of love. And again, it's been taken away from us, but it's such a powerful term. It's such a powerful term. And it comes back to basics. And so with parenting, it comes back to really five key, and I would apply these same five pieces to mentorship. It's only going to be, though, in a slightly different, just a different approach and area to it. So parenting, there's this deep familial piece that goes with it, but it comes back to five essentials. It comes back to trust. So parents must build trust with their children. Okay, so again, that trust is there, and trust is vulnerability based. It means that the parents have to be vulnerable with their children to say, I messed up, I made a mistake, I need your forgiveness, as well as children understanding and trusting their parents implicitly that they have their best interest in mind, that whether they are disciplining them or just, again, holding them in love and esteem, that it's all coming from the same place. It's all coming from love as they're taking them along that journey. And then along the way, and this is where parents
so before
really...
Before we go to the next piece, though, something that you mentioned in that statement is like the concept of vulnerability. It seems to me like there's a bit of that kind of both in the role of the parent and in the role of the child. Can you kind of talk a little bit more about that?
Yep, absolutely. So that role of vulnerability comes with both. Is, again, we live in a world that says we can't let people see you make mistakes. You can't let... You know, people think that you're wrong. You can't, yeah. And that's what we talk about with vulnerability, is that we have to be comfortable with the child going to the parent and saying, I need your help. I need your help. And maybe it's not even that they messed up, but it's just, I need your help. And the parents being able to go to the children and say, you know, I really wasn't a good parent yesterday. When I blew up, I should never have done that. I please forgive me for that. And yeah, so the vulnerability has to be on both sides. And we could go through 1,000 different examples of that. But being vulnerable really gets down to that it's okay to say, I need you. And parents need their children and their love just as much as the children need the parents and their love. It's a reciprocal piece.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. And then once you have that true trust, then guess what? I want... every relationship, including the mentoring piece too, to have conflict. And what I mean by conflict is not, you know, grade school conflict. My dad can beat up your dad. Your face is ugly. You're stupid. And then we start punching each other. That's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is the ability to have disagreement, to push back, iron sharpening iron, so to say, to have these really deep discussions about issues and ideas and thoughts, and just to be open. To be honest. But if you don't have trust, you can't have those open, honest discussions. And then what happens?
I want to ask you something.
And yeah, go ahead.
This could be completely out there, and you can correct me on it if I'm wrong. But it seems like to me, when we're talking about kind of like healthy conflict and being able to manage it, is it possible that maybe like that starts out with some of those more childish kind of conflicts that we have as children, as like whoever is stronger than whoever, or like I can do this, and like that kind of like the ego or id centeredness in that sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Yep, it can. And what you want to do as a parent is help, again, coach that, lead that, redirect that. So instead of saying it this way, here's a better way to say this. You know, doing it because it is learning. You're not going to expect a 3-year-old to have the same level of conflict that you would expect, hopefully, from a 35-year-old parent. So again, absolutely, Ruth, it's a learning process, it's a growth process, and to do that. And you can start with those childish ones, so to say, and learn from that, and grow from that. And that's going to be, you know, something that down the road that we're going to talk about failing forward, that we can't be afraid to fail. It's okay. And that's part of that healthy conflict, is to say, hey, it's okay. Hey, you tried. I messed up. You messed up. We messed up. It's okay, but we're trying. What do we learn from that? How do we grow? Rather than just stuffing and stuffing and stuffing, as if we just keep stuffing or hiding it or not embracing it, however you want to put it, then we're going to explode. And that's when parent-child relationships blow up. That's when mentors and mentees fall apart is when they can't come together on that.
So I'm going to maybe preview a little bit, like, the next episode, kind of looking into the reconciliation piece of that, like resurrecting relationships. One of the things that I've noticed as I've kind of been like scrolling on social media is the patterns and or trends of like breaking off kind of relationships. And I think to an extent that can be healthy, but can you talk about maybe like where that's not?
When it comes to family, I would try to take that to the nth level before you would so to say take a break from a relationship or cut off a relationship. Just meaning from the standpoint of the fact that you know families go through bumps, bruises, all of that. However, if the relationship is just completely one-sided or hurtful or abusive, those things. You have to protect yourself. So there, you know, if we're going to and talk about that extreme, but if the disagreement is over, I've seen this on social media. If the disagreement is on political views, you got someone in the family who's Republican, someone who's a Democrat, and they say, well, we're never talking to each other again because of that. That's where I'm going to say, let's talk through this. Let's get to the point where we can come together. But if someone's abusive and hurtful, then we have to put an end to it. And I'll go into the mentor piece in a second.
I have kind of a question there, though, because I feel like sometimes, not all the time, because sometimes I do agree with you, it can kind of go to an extreme, and I've seen that too. But I feel like sometimes there's maybe like a little bit of a crossover between toxic and abusive and political views, especially when looking at some things. So, what are your thoughts on that, and kind of where do you draw the line?
I think if that becomes, I think that right, correct. Those conversations can fall apart into becoming toxic and abusive. Where again, when you start making personal attacks against people, that's where you've got to take a break. And I don't know if it's just take a time out, take a break for a day, a week, a month, whatever it would be, but you got to take a break because no good's going to come. That's not positive conflict. Positive conflict is when you're talking about what's your purpose, what's my mission, what's my vision, what's my value, what are my values? And again, if things go against it and you can't do it, then you're going to have to take that break. But hopefully my encouragement is you would come back to it. You would come back to it, not just take a forever break. Now, with mentoring, that could be a little bit different. So when you're mentoring someone, because it's not necessarily a family connection, but when you're mentoring someone, if you have a mentorship where you, and this is what I tell people with mentoring, you've got to match up with your mentor and your mentee. If that relationship's not working, that's okay. Doesn't make either one better or worse or good or bad. But if the mentee is what I would call a vampire, and why I call a vampire is where they just suck the life and energy out of you and never really take your advice and just are, then you as a mentor have to get out of it. And vice versa for a mentee, if the mentor is really not helping and providing information or encouragement that's leading you in a positive direction, then there's nothing wrong with breaking that relationship and saying, thanks, we tried, you know, this is just not working. And then, so when I go into mentoring relationship, coaching relationship, I always say that. I always say, if you ever feel like I'm not helping you, if you ever feel like we've run our course, I'm not going to be offended when you say, I need to go to the next level. I need to find someone else. And I'll be like, thank you. God bless you. And that's great. So again, there are those times and moments. And then, like I said, once you've had that ability to debate, you have that positive debate back and forth, like you and I have, then you can have true commitment. Commitment means, yeah, even though we disagree on some things, we're committed. We're committed to this relationship. We're committed to our family. We're committed to the mentoring piece. And then we hold each other accountable. And what I mean by accountability is, again, accountability is the highest form of praise. When we hold our children accountable, our husband, wife, this, that, our family accountable, we're saying they are important and what they're doing is important. Mm-hmm. if we don't hold people accountable, what we're really doing is we're disrespecting them. We're saying your thoughts don't matter, what you're doing doesn't matter, because I'm just going to do my own thing anyway. And then hopefully what that all leads to are positive outcomes, positive family life, positive mentoring situations, forward steps where we start to see the success. And if we could practice this model, but again, going back to the fundamental level of trust, but I'm going to say that trust being vulnerability-based trust, but going back even just a little bit deeper, that fundamental level is that we view each other in love. Now, again, I'm not talking about physical love. I'm not talking, please don't send me to the HR department for that. What I'm saying, again, is that love is this idea of care, concern, servant leadership, being willing to make sacrifices for the good of others. Now, not to the detriment, to complete detriment of yourself, but again, you know, doing those things. So if we can come back to that. And boy, if we could do that with parents and build from there, relationships, mentoring, coaching, I think we got something. Then we can work forward from there.
And I think to an extent, maybe one of the things that makes it hard for people to actually still kind of operate in that sense where they're like okay with that has to do with like our relationships that we have with ourselves today versus like the relationships that people maybe had 50 or so years ago, because there were less things coming in at you. Like now you have like technology, you have like basically it boils down to different technology, from music to videos to like different like marketing messages and everything else coming at you like 100 miles a minute. Versus before, when you had more time to spend with yourself and understanding yourself and where you're coming from. Because when there is more of an understanding of oneself, I think it's probably easier to, and maybe not always like easier, but it's less complex of an issue to be able to both accept and to give in that sort of sense. And in that way, I guess like that could also be like part of what could undermine things like vulnerability. But what are your thoughts on that?
No, I think you're spot on. So what I tell people is you first of all have to be in love with yourself. And that takes time to reflect. You got to take that the right way, but meaning not in an egotistical way, but saying and being able to look in the mirror and saying, you know, I'm fearfully and wonderfully made, going back and saying, it's awesome to be me. Not from an egotistical standpoint, but if we can't love ourselves, and I think you raise a great point there. If we can't love ourselves, how can we? You know, it's the old it's the oxygen mask on the airplane. You know, put your oxygen mask on first before trying to help others. If you're not breathing, we can't help others breathe. So again, it's going back to those fundamentals. And you're right, Ruth, is that we don't take time. We live in this world. Go world that doesn't necessarily, and maybe it's more Western culture than anything. It's more that rugged individualism thing that, you know, we've heard or been taught or whatever it would be. And rather than taking the time to be reflective, to really learn ourselves, to be able to be the best for others.
I think it's a good segue kind of into the next topic when we're talking about culture and food, as we're talking about loving yourself, because I think as we're talking about that, one of the elements that's in that is self-care. We kind of talked a second ago about how things can be kind of rushing here and there, like, and feeding into kind of our psyches, as far as like the way that affects our ability to receive and give love and things of that nature, but also the things that we put into our body contribute to that as well. And I think that especially also comes down to it when we're talking about things like culture and food. The way I've seen that kind of for me is that I used to have, and in some instances, it is something that I still struggle with, kind of like an issue with food, just because I viewed it as a thing that it was more mechanistic than anything else. But kind of as I have started to view it in a different way, kind of having more fun with the cooking process and things like that, even within budget restraints and all of that, like it is something that I'm finding is more of like a self-care kind of thing. Do you cook at all? Or are you more of like a McDonald's kind of person?
Well, by both and. I cook. I enjoy much more grilling, mm-hmm. working with the meat, potato, vegetable type of thing, you know, but more from just a straightforward approach with that. Some creativity with it, of course, but
you know. By the way, I'm very proud of you.
Oh, thanks. Thanks.
You added vegetables to that list.
Yeah, no. I enjoy vegetables, but I like to, you know, doctor them up, you know, green beans with, you know, so fresh. I like fresh vegetables, not, you know, I'm not talking about canned vegetables. Canned beans are fine. I mean, baked beans, et cetera. But I don't really count that as a vegetable. I don't think it is. It's a legume or whatever, but getting down to it, but green beans, Brussels sprouts, all that. Love cooking up that stuff, working with that in different creative ways. And again, meat products from, I'm not a big pork person. Don't really like pork as much. Ham is too salty, but working with steak, you know, if you count hot dogs as meat, I enjoy, you know, a good grilled hot dog or something like that. But yeah.
You do eat pork. You just eat the basic version of pork.
Yes, there you go. That's correct. That's correct. So yeah, but I do agree with you that it's a huge piece of self-care. And food is food's a struggle for a lot of people. It's a struggle for me when I'm traveling. So you talked about McDonald's or cooking. I do a lot of traveling. When I'm traveling, it is so much easier to pick up McDonald's or Chick-fil-A or Jimmy John's, you know, whatever's along the way. And I know that those are not as good and or as healthy a choice as, you know, taking time for the cooking. Now, with me, I'm so time oriented. My biggest frustration with cooking is just the sheer amount of time. And yeah, I'm going somewhere with this, but the sheer amount of time of got to buy the food, you got to prep the food, you've got to cook the food, you got to clean the dishes, you got to take time to eat it. It's just so much time that I have to get myself out of that negative space of the time and find ways to enjoy it. Like you said it perfectly. And I hadn't thought about it that way, but self-care. That the process and everything included with it should be a part of, it should be an enjoyable piece of self-care, something that helps us to decompress and you know, regain focus on good things. So I love what you said there with that. That gives me a new way to look at it. So spot on.
Okay, I have to take a cheap shot. So I'm going to ask you something. I don't know if you've seen it or not. Have you seen the McDonald's CEO video that's been going around?
Yeah, him biting into the arch burger, the big arch burger and things that way.
Yes.
Yeah, I have. I've seen that. And
so I'm going to ask you about that, both because you mentioned in your intro that you used to work with McDonald's and also because you are talking about eating McDonald's as you're on the go. So how do you feel about that?
Well, one side of me is I smile at it, laugh at it, and I can't wait to try my first arch burger. So there's the one side of me. And then the other side of me is, man, as long as we can do it in moderation. So if I start eating arch burgers for every meal, I'm in big trouble. Mm-hmm. But if I have one every great once in a while as a guilty pleasure, I'm going to be okay with that. Others may not, but I'm going to be okay with that. And the important thing with food is you've got to be okay with it to a certain degree. Now, again, I'm not advocating eating an arch burger for every meal. That would be really bad idea. But, you know, I know people that love, so coming from McDonald's world, they just can't wait for, and right now, you know, Shamrock Shakes, you know, that's, you know, the different, great, have a Shamrock Shake or two. Just don't have 40 of them, you know, in a sitting, because that's not going to go well.
But so basically what you're saying is seeing that video makes you want to try the arch burger.
Yep. There you go. There's my confession. There's my confession.
Because when I saw that, I was like, I don't know if I even want to, because look how tiny that bite was.
There's maybe a piece of me that will think that, but then there's the challenge with it too. So there you go.
But what is your typical McDonald's order?
Oh, I like the McNuggets. So, you know, 20-piece McNuggets with sweet and sour sauce. I like quarter pounder with cheese with extra onions, you know. So I don't get fries usually, even though I don't mind. I like the fries, but I don't. I prefer more just the sandwich and the food. So that's what I would get, something like that.
So I'm kind of the opposite. If I'm going for McDonald's, I'm usually either going to get like the fries or ice cream.
Well, I serve plenty of people like you that like the fries and ice cream, and then they would dip the fries into the ice cream to get the sweet and the salty. So
I'm not quite there. I'm not quite there, but definitely fries or ice cream.
All right. And again, always in, just like with anything, just I don't guilt people. If somebody wants to have a Snicker bar, go for it. Great, go for it. Like you said, it's self-care. It's about feeling good. But again, I guess I would discourage, and I'm not a dietitian, so I'm not here trying to claim to be. But, you know, don't have 20 a day. That's probably not a good idea. Probably not a good idea. So, again, it's just some of those ideas and concepts. But people struggle with that. I have people that I coach that are in different dietary programs. I have my own, you know, like I said, when I travel, I guarantee you, if people looked at my travel menu schedule, they would be very critical of that.
Do you eat when you travel?
Well, that's a great question too. It depends upon the day. If it gets too late, I'm just like, forget it. I don't have the time. I don't have the patience. I don't have, you know, in my hotel room necessarily something that I can prep and do something with. And, mm-hmm. you know, and if it's really late at night, you know, a lot of things close, and I'm not a White Castle person. So, you know, just, you know, things that are more open 24 hours a day. Yeah, it depends. So again, like I said, I'm not here to guilt anyone. I'm not here to shame anyone. But I love what you said, which is cultural food, healthy food, or again, being a part of self-care. What does it look like for you for self-care? That's such a great point. Going back to that, Ruth.
So I guess we're going now from ice cream into entrepreneurship. What are some of your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's a great segue into that. So let me just go back to just this base level idea of entrepreneurship. Entrepreneurship is not for everyone. It's not for everyone. I truly believe that there are certain individuals that are really, really gifted with this entrepreneurial spirit of wanting to do a startup, of wanting to do something original, creative, new. And that's awesome. That's great. And you should lean into that strength. And I'll go deeper.
I'm going to stop you right there, because I know you have some other things that you want to say. And I'm going to let you get to that. But I do have another question that I kind of want to ask as well, because what we've kind of done, and I don't know if we did that intentionally or not, but we kind of pigeonholed entrepreneurship into startups.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be startups. It can be creative ideas. It can be creative thoughts. But it's usually this. Usually the purest of entrepreneurial pieces is something you have an idea and you want to get that idea out there into public for public consumption or with others. And it could be private. It doesn't have to be a business. But when you say the word entrepreneurship, it's linked to how do we turn this into a product that we can develop and sell to others? That's what comes with it. When I taught a course, so I taught a graduate level course on entrepreneurial education. Well, what was the essence of that was it was being creative in the educational world to again, be creative, very specifically, not just with how we're educating, but in particular, how we funded our schools. Because schools, especially inner city urban schools, with which I have a primary focus on, are completely underfunded. And it's a model here in this country, and I don't want to take you all deep into that model of, you know, taxes and levies and all these different things. But again, if you're going into an inner city urban school, you have to have this entrepreneurial mindset that we've got to figure out ways to creatively fund our model so that we can provide the best for our children. So again, you know, it's not just startups. I agree with you. Correct. And I didn't mean to make it sound like that, but it's usually someone has this really creative idea for how to increase funding, resources, or with a product or a design or a method, however you want to put it. You can almost call entrepreneurship synonymous with creativity and originality. That's how I'd view it. Now, there's nothing wrong with not being the creative one, not being those types of things. And there's some people that are just way, 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 way more comfortable going into a known system and a known product and just following that path, and that's okay. But the ones that usually have this entrepreneurial spirit are the ones that are risk takers. They're ones that are willing to step outside of the box. And however you want to put it, you can apply it to anything, like I said. But really, if you're going to do that, if you're going to be entrepreneurial, my encouragement is that you've got to go back to these three things. And just very simply, you've got to have a clear mission of what am I doing and why am I doing it? So mission is what and why. What am I doing? Why am I doing it? So I'm creating this product to help people. You know, let's take it with food. I'm creating this new cooking apparatus to help people cut down on time for how long it takes to cook so that they can have a more quality time with other people. You know, whatever. That's really generic. But again, you've got to start with a mission. What am I doing? Why am I doing it? Mm-hmm. And if you've got something, you got a prime mind. If you can understand what I'm doing and why I'm doing it, that's awesome. That then can push forward and energize that entrepreneurial process. Then the other thing that you've got to have, so again, it's MVV. So it's mission, vision, values. So the next thing you have to have, once you have your mission, you've got to have your vision. So if the mission is what and why, then the vision is where. Where do I want to take this? And it doesn't mean I'm going to take over the world. You know, that's where many entrepreneurial ideas die, because they right away try to take over the world rather than taking over maybe their area or a piece or a community, or just saying, I'm going to create this for these 300 students at a school, or I'm going to create this for my members at the church because this is going to help them. You know, start with that vision. The vision can expand as you go along, but start with that. You know, you got to have that initial vision. Where am I going? So mission, what and why, vision, where.
Yeah, I think when you're talking about like the expanding and starting with somewhere simple, like one of the examples that gets brought up a lot, I would say, is like Amazon and the way they started out, like selling books, and now they're giving you your prescription medication.
Yep, they're giving you a lot of stuff, that's for sure. But we won't go too deep.
Why even ask more about that?
Yeah, so... it's like Christmas every day here at my house with Amazon packages coming every day. So it's amazing. But I agree with you. Yep. So the vision will morph. The vision will morph over time. Usually your mission doesn't change too much. It maybe expands a little bit, but it usually doesn't change too much over time. You're committed to that. But vision will morph as hopefully you grow if that's your desire. And then the last piece is you have to have clear values. And the value is simple. Keep them simple. Less is more. 3 to 5, maybe 3 to 6 values. But the values are these undeniable principles that guide and lead you. So I will say this, and again, I won't use any names to get us in trouble, but I'll just say large computer companies right nowadays, they started with these values of family, culture, you know, camaraderie, trust, whatever it would be. But then they grew into these multi-mega million, zillion-dollar companies. And I can tell you from people that I've talked to that work for these large tech companies, they said, when I was first there, when we were starting out, it was about our culture, it was about the people, it was about service, it was about... And they said, 15 years now later, I couldn't do it because we weren't living those values anymore. Those values were not important. It became about the dollar. It became about, you know, you get it out, and not about the people. So again, what I'm saying is, if you're really going to take entrepreneurial steps and be an entrepreneur, is you've got to be clear about the what and the why, your mission. You've got to be clear about the vision, where we're going, and you want to stay true to those core values. Because if you start losing those core values, you may have the greatest success, you may have the greatest product, but you're not going to have true success and meaning behind it. So that's really in essence what it boils down. There's a lot more that goes into it. There's a lot of things, a lot of risk, a lot of challenges, a lot of opportunities. But again, go do it. If you're motivated to do it and you have that desire, give it a shot. What's the worst you're going to do? And that'll get us into a module later on, a discussion later on. What's the worst you're going to do? Hopefully fail, but fail forward and learn from it. So,
yeah, that's a lot of good points there. Also, notice you use the word module. Anybody down here?
Well, why I say
module coming out?
why I say module is because, again, just like with entrepreneurial education, it's a course I taught. One of the components of that course that I taught was a component on failing forward. So I revert to educational terminology every once in a while, different things. So it's more a discussion, What does that mean? So that's a cliffhanger. That's something to entice people to tune back in at some point and really understand what it means to fail forward.
Well, I mean, I think we've had a pretty solid conversation for today. I look forward to connecting with everyone again during the next episode. Thank you for listening to the Ruth and Scott podcast.